Thanks very much, Lars. It's really a pleasure to be here. I've been hearing about this place for years and years and years, and I'm glad I finally made it. In October, I couldn't make it to the meeting because I was at this very nice telescope. Let's see. Is this focused? How does this one work?
That's a really great moon.
We
don't have a moon
this time. Yes. This picture was taken by one of the guys who's doing SETI work, searching for extraterrestrials, so evidently he also did something quite, well, useful, nice, real here. So, unfortunately, the things I'm going to be talking about all have to do or are derived from the multi-beam work, the pulsar server, because that's more or less what I've been working on for the past several years. So here's a brief outline, and some of these things have been touched upon during the meeting back in October, but hopefully I'll talk about enough different things that even those of you who were here then, thank you, won't be bored. So the Parkes multi-beam survey, the survey which has been going on for 3 years now and should be done within the next year or so, basically aims to cover the galactic plane, a thin strip of the galactic plane, with very high sensitivity, searching for very distant pulsars. And of course, since it's looking along the galactic plane, it's going to find young pulsars. And I will discuss one or two of those briefly. Also, while carrying out the survey, we tend to find a few binary pulsars. And of course, we're always interested in finding unusual systems and also learning more about the types of systems that we already know of to try to do some statistics, try to figure out, learn more about their demographics and so on. And I will mention something about several of these intermediate mass systems that we found recently, which I think at first was a bit of a surprise, but I'll suggest why I don't think it's such a surprise anymore. But I would like to discuss some of these things with you during the week that I'm here, because I'm certainly not clear on explanations for some of these discoveries that we have, as it were. And this system is quite interesting. It's a very high mass binary pulsar. We can learn something about interactions of the pulsar with the wind of a companion, hopefully, from this system. As well, it has some implications on evolution of binary systems, high mass extra binaries, and so on. And then finally, in the end, I will talk about something which is not strictly speaking related to the Parkes multi-beam survey, although it uses much of the same equipment, and that's work on globular clusters that is ongoing. So I wasn't sure what audience I was going to have to begin with, so I had prepared some basic sort of pulsar sheets here, which I don't have to put up, obviously, for this audience. I think in this page, the only thing I'll remark upon is this business of the breaking indices. As you all know, one tends to assume that the breaking index of pulsars is 3 because we simply cannot measure it for the vast majority of pulsars. There are now 5 measurements, and they range between 1.5 and 3. And one of those measurements is on this one young pulsar that I'll briefly touch upon in a few minutes. But so, of course, this is always something to keep in mind, because it does affect the spin evolution, or what we think we know about the spin evolution of the neutron stars, the inferred magnetic field, and in particular, the ages of these objects. So here's the ubiquitous PPDOT diagram, somewhat updated. Again, I don't have to dwell on this. This is the one young system I will mention briefly in a minute. As you can see, it's very young. It's in a supernova remnant. Here are the SGRs and AXPs, and here are the binary pulsars, which formerly, if you looked at this diagram maybe 2 years ago, you wouldn't have seen nearly as many systems in this region here. Two or three of these, or four in fact, are double neutron star systems, highly eccentric orbits, but now there are a few others which are circular binaries, some of them with somewhat higher mass than the typical low-mass binary pulsar, and their evolution, their history, I don't think is yet entirely clear. But these have been found, many of these have been found recently, in fact, in the Parkes survey. And in another survey done by the group at Swinburne, Matthew Bales and Russell Edwards, they've also been finding some interesting objects there. So, going on,
So just that PP dot diagram then has all the new pulsars that you've...
Well, not quite. As I'll mention in a second, we've now, the multi-beam survey has found something like 580 pulsars to date. It takes a year or more to get the period derivatives for many of these pulsars. So by now we have something like 300 PP dots for the new pulsars. This diagram actually only has about 100 of those. If I were to plot those 300 P dots in slightly different color, the vast majority, of course, are isolated pulsars with ages between of the order of a million years, as is typical. You could argue they seem to be a bit, they seem to be distributed a bit higher. They seem to have slightly higher P dots than the vast majority of the pulsars. Not too much, but a little bit. You know, they seem to be slightly younger than the average and so on, which makes sense because they're along the galactic plane. I'll mention one other thing, but in a different context here. So, all right, a brief summary of where the Parkes multibeam survey stands and what we're doing. So, like I said, we've been doing this for about 3 years now, and it's three quarters done. The idea is to cover a latitude range of plus or minus 5 degrees along the galactic plane, and the longitude range of 100 degrees sort of towards the galactic center, from minus 100 to plus 50 degrees. And we do this very sort of quickly, rapidly, because we have this wonderful 13-beam receiver system that enables us to look at 13 different positions on the sky all at once.
Are they simultaneously using it for H1 or something like that? Or?
They use it for H1 survey, but not simultaneously. We briefly thought of doing that. It would have been a wonderful use of the telescope, very efficient. But we just do different things. They want to do sort of beam switching, looking position back and forth, and we don't want to do that. And so I think it worked out better this way. Here's a depiction of the Taylor and Cordes model, the electron density model. That's the grayscale here with spiral arms, the sun, the galactic center. And overlaying on this are the three-dimensional, in this case two-dimensional positions of the new pulsars, the red stars, and old pulsars, which are these little blue dots.
So you have a published list of dispersion measures and distances?
Yes.
Yes. That's all on the web?
So what we do is we put the pulsar information on the web essentially when we get the timing solution, about 18 months after the discovery. So if you go to the web page, there'll be, I think, over 200 odd pulsars there now. So probably about half of the ones we've found so far. Yes. So here's the inferred distance, of course, from this model. And the model is the best that has been available for a while, but it's not perfect, obviously. But the one thing you can definitely already see from here is that the red pulsars tend to be much further away from the sun than the blue pulsars, than the previously known pulsars, as is expected. And there's perhaps almost an unreasonably good match, I would say, between the positions of many of the pulsars and the spiral arms. Particularly this inner spiral arm, you really can see it. So over-density of pulsars here. And even on the second spiral arm, there's quite a few. And I don't know.
Yeah, that is, sort of by definition.
Well, yes, and no. Okay, yes.
Yes.
So of course there's some bias, but not necessarily. You can imagine that the model, in fact, is correct. Let's say from by definition, and then you wonder whether pulsars are born along spiral arms, and so whether you should find them there.
I'm just wondering, suppose that you have a completely uniform distribution in the end, and you put that model, and then
there's obviously some bias, but the point is now we have enough pulsars, enough VMs and so on, that one can actually ask that question and wonder how.
That's not what Dick Manchester said when he talked about this. He said that it was likely due to the...
Dick, we have slightly different opinions.
Remember that you recorded live on the web.
Yes. Dick, you're a great guy.
Does anyone believe that pulsars are forming spiral arms?
No, I'm just arguing that it's maybe not.
I'm sorry, I have to point out that up to this point, the discussion has been kind of in code for somebody who doesn't know what's going on here.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
What is the bias that's...
Oh, I'm sorry. So the underlying model, there's a very high density of electrons along the spiral arms in the model by definition.
And you measure the electron column, right?
You measure the integrated column density of electrons, the dispersion measure, that's what it is. And that just naturally attracts the pulsars in this diagram to the spiral arms a little bit. But again, there's some biasing factor, but then there's the underlying reality. And yes, about a year ago when I sort of first made such an image for the Bond conference, and I was talking to Jim Cortes by email, he was impressed at how good the fit was at first, and then we started wondering about biases and so on. And I think
that's neat, just a big test.
Yes, and also, well, obviously Jim and other people have been working on improving this distance model.
Right. Also, you can test it in a very sort of relative sense. You know that the older ones should not be as close. So if you find that the younger ones are actually statistically more closer to the arms than the older ones, that will be pretty clear.
Anyway, we can discuss some of those things later.
What does it mean? You wrote from that last transparency 580 plus 740 plus 100. What's
yes.
The extra 100?
So 740 pulsars were about the number of pulsars that were known before the survey was started, over 30 years of pulsar searching. And in 3 years, we've almost doubled that amount. And in the meantime, other surveys have discovered about 100 pulsars as well. So this is the number of pulsars known nowadays, more or less. So just to finish the brief summary of the survey where it stands, Dick Manchester and a bunch of us just submitted a paper this week or last week on the first 100 pulsars. It describes the whole system very in great detail, the whole survey, and then presents the parameters for the first pulsars. And what you see here is a histogram of dispersion measures for these first 100 pulsars. And here is the dispersion measure of all previously known pulsars, and these are scaled so as to have the same area. So the obvious thing that you see is that the new pulsars have much higher dispersion measures, they're much further away on average. Then that's just as it should be, as we expect. And here we plotted the flux density of these 100 pulsars. And that's really remarkable. What you don't see here is that of all previously known pulsars, of the 750 pulsars, two-thirds of them have a measured flux density at this frequency, at 20 centimeters. So 500 of them have such a measured flux density. And only 50 of them or so have flux density less than 1 millijansky. So we've already doubled the number of really, really weak pulsars. And you might say, well, weak pulsars, you know, great. But it just goes to show how very sensitive this survey is. They are weak, but that's because they're generally far away. They're actually quite luminous pulsars. And this plot I show here, I definitely don't want you to look at it in any great detail, is just to point out these are the pulse shapes of 50 of those 100 pulsars. And you see three or four examples here where there's a clear one-sided exponential tail. And this is not intrinsic to the pulse shape, it's due to scattering in the interstellar medium. And this sort of information that we can get from any of these pulsars, together with the dispersion measures, really hopefully will go. This is all radio, yes. This will go a long way towards improving the distance models somewhat. Yes. And hopefully we can make some measurements at other frequencies, lower frequencies, like at the Westerbork telescope at 800 megahertz and get better results. So going on to young pulsars. So 10% or so of the pulsars that we are finding, it's slightly, a little less than 10%, but it's about 10%, have characteristic ages of less than 100,000 years, which is a sort of relatively young pulsar, I suppose, in some sense. And here's essentially the same PP dot diagram that I showed you earlier, except now I don't worry so much about binary pulsars, so I don't highlight them. And I highlight instead these two radio pulsars here. And I also have this line that comes more or less from a model of Baring and Harding, which I'll talk about very briefly. So I have these two pulsars here, and this was published earlier this year, and then there are the SGRs and the AXPs there. And the first pulsar is this one here, 1814 minus 1744. And you can argue all you want about it, but I would say, you know, if you didn't know anything about these systems a priori, you might have said, oh, this guy sort of looks like has spin parameters that are similar to these guys here, to these AXPs. So you might wonder if their emission properties and so on, just based on spin parameters, are anything alike. And they clearly are not. This is a fine AXP, and this is a fine radio pulsar. The pulsar has a period of 4 seconds, characteristic age of under 100,000 years, has the highest magnetic field inferred for radio pulsars, for sort of standard radio pulsars. And the spin parameters, like I said, are sort of similar to this particular AXP. We've looked for X-ray emission from this radio pulsar, and we don't find any. Placing an upper limit, we see that the luminosity, the X-ray luminosity, really is smaller than that for this AXP.
How much smaller, by
the way? Depending, of course, on things that we don't know exactly, like distance and so on, but being conservative, a factor of 5 at least smaller or so. It could be quite a bit less. And the pulsar, as is sort of common among many young pulsars, has some amount of timing noise. Of course, we've only been looking at this for a couple of years now, and we have not seen any glitches so far. Whereas this pulsar, the AXP, does not slow down, apparently, in a very steady manner. It also shows some sort of amount of timing noise, but I think Vicky Caspian and collaborators have shown that there are other stranger things going on with the spin evolution of that AXP. So, but time will tell whether this radio pulsar is in any sense unusual among radio pulsars. It has the highest magnetic field. But my prediction right now would be that probably not. You know, we might see glitches as we do among other radio pulsars, but...
By normal timing noise, you mean the delta 8 parameters?
Yeah, normal amounts of, timing noise. The sort of frequency second derivative, which is not secular, which is due to irregularities in the spin, is what you might expect. And, of course, it's a perfectly normal radio pulsar. It has normal radio luminosity and parameters, despite the fact that its magnetic field is somewhat higher than this so-called quantum critical magnetic field. And the point of this Baring and Harding line here is that, according to some theories anyway, you might expect there not to be radio emission from pulsars more or less above this line. Now, I noticed that since, in the past year, they've come up with sort of revisions and changes to this.
Revisions predate the data, actually.
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine.
We expect that this would happen.
Right. What comes first?
I'll go on top of the AXP, too, because that's...
You can go to infinity, essentially.
Oh, but does it boot include the AXPs?
Yeah, right. So, I mean, the critical point is it's right next to an AXP, does 2D
define the
problem or not?
Yeah.
So now we'll just have to find another radio pulsar sort of farther up here, and then we'll...
It's basically radio emitters, and that doesn't validate anything.
That's true, we just might not see them.
Is the pulse profile of that pulsar usual in any ways? It's
narrow.
No,
it's narrow, but not among the narrowest. It's less than 10%. It's about 5% duty cycle. It's normal. Right, so much for that one right now. And then there's the Sella pulsar, which I really like. It's a neat radio pulsar, I think. That one has a period of 0.4 seconds, a standard pulse period, except it has a very, very high period derivative. It has the highest period derivative among all the radio pulsars. And that suggests a characteristic age of only 1,600 years, which is definitely very young. Also a high magnetic field. That one, this one I just talked about, and this other pulsar, all of them discovered in the multi-beam survey, have the three highest inferred magnetic fields among radio pulsars. Because it has such a high period derivative, we've been able to measure it in only about a year. The period second derivative, which is secular, and that suggests, that gives you an index, a breaking index of 2.91. This uncertainty takes into account timing noise and other things that you might worry about. Glitches, which it has glitched, this pulsar. I think somewhat surprisingly, it's a crab-like glitch. It's a small glitch, but very clear. And when I say somewhat surprisingly, is because the crab glitches, but it only has really glitched half a dozen times or so, glitches of this size over 30 years. Whereas we've looked at this one for 1 year and it has a glitch, perhaps even a second glitch. So either we were unreasonably lucky or it glitches more often than the crab.
The number makes sense and the Milatus prediction?
Yes, Milatus is 1997, I believe, paper. Yes, it makes some sense, this number. And it's the closest, by the way, to 3 among any radio pulsars.
What's X-ray flux?
I'm sorry?
X-ray flux.
X-ray flux from this one?
Yeah.
I will talk about that in just one second.
Yes? I just want to ask, it seems to be interesting to me that the three highest beat pulsars are all found in this survey. Do you think that's just luck, or do you think that this survey is in some way selecting for high beat pulsars? Are they lower luminosity pulsars?
No, I'd say that the pulsars we are finding are on average high radioluminosity pulsars. They are far away, and they are actually. So on average, now you could say, well, if there's a correlation, if high B field pulsars have high luminosities, well, then you might expect us to find high B pulsars. But I think it's more, my impression is it's just more a matter of numbers and statistics. We found 580 pulsars. We've already trebled, or nearly, I think, quadrupled the number of known pulsars along the galactic plane. And they're clear. So the fact that we found one or two that appear to be slightly unusual in some sense, I think when you work out the numbers, it's not that unreasonable.
Yeah. But, I mean, the distribution of magnetic field falls off like some sort of Gaussian or exponential. Just to find the three highest things, more than you might expect, just by saying, oh, well, we've found one. We've almost doubled the number of
known pulsars. Yeah, okay, so I haven't, I think you should think of it, we've quadrupled the number of sort of young pulsars, ones with ages less than 100,000 years. So is it unexpected that you should find the three highest magnetic fields there? I haven't done the numbers, but you might be right.
To what extent is your assertion that the higher luminosity is contingent upon the Taylor and Cordes model? I mean, if you supposed to have, if you had uniform density smearing, what's the mean distance relative to the ones and the luminosities? I mean, you change that result. So
yeah, yeah. Okay, I don't have a quantitative.
Quantitative change. Is what I'm saying.
Well, I don't have a quantitative answer to your question, but. I would be very surprised.
Right.
Of course, the Taylor and Cordes model, for instance, it did some things with respect to previous models, some very systematic things, like it pushed many of the local pulsars further away by a factor of a few, for instance. And that just discontinuously made, for instance, millisecond pulsars suddenly much more luminous than they were previously, which made them more rare in models, mm-hmm. which sort of made the so-called birth rate problem that Narayan and Kulkarni pointed out between low-mass X-ray binaries and low-mass binary pulses. It made that problem kind of go away, more or less, just sort of discontinuously. So these are some of the things you have to worry about. And so I don't know if that's exactly what you're referring to, but something I get from your question is, sure, if the present model still has some bias inlet at intermediate distances in the galaxy, let's say, and all these pulses are, in fact, closer by a factor of two or three, then that would reduce their luminosities, it's true. I would be surprised if that were the case, but yes. On the other hand, I will point out for those of you who don't deal with this very much, yes, for a given pulsar, for sure, you cannot trust, I think, the distance model to more than a factor of, let's say, two, is my feeling. Even though you read the paper and they say statistical uncertainty and so on of maybe 25% or 25%, but that's for a sample as a whole. For individual objects, I wouldn't trust the distance to more than a factor of two. So I was asked about X-ray emission from this young pulsar. Well, it's a young pulsar, 1600 years characteristic age. And of course, since we have actually measured the breaking index, we don't have to assume a breaking index of 3. At least that's one thing you don't have to assume. So it's a natural thing to go and search for a supernova remnant around this pulsar. And in fact, there is one, visible in both radio and X-rays. So this is a supernova remnant. This is some work done by Frony Crawford and Brian Gainsler and some others at the Compact Array in Australia. And you see this very nice radio shell, 15 arc minutes in diameter. It has a non-thermal emissions, spectral index of about minus 0.6. And the pulsar is right in the center. You cannot see the pulsar here in radio, so it's very weak. We see the pulsed emission, obviously. That's how we found the pulsar. But we don't see any Plarion at the center, any synchrotron nebula at the center. But definitely we believe that this pulsar is associated with this supernova remnant. The age estimates agree, and of course these are just estimates sort of with large uncertainties, but they do agree. And the pulsar is not much very offset from the center at all, from the geometric center, so you don't need any ridiculous velocity to associate this pulsar with the supernova remnant. In fact, the velocity of 300, 400 kilometers per second will more than do. And then there's just a small chance, small probability of chance alignment. So these are associated. And we do see it in X-rays. Here's the sort of X-ray emission with ASCA. We see in X-rays, we see this something that's consistent with a point source, which is offset from the pulsar by almost 1.5 arc minutes, which is a little more than you would like with ASCA. 1.5 arc minutes, it's not unheard of, but it's quite a bit. So it's not yet clear whether that X-ray point source is in fact associated with the pulsar, whether it's perhaps the pulsar itself or a planarian, or whether it's just an unrelated background object. Hopefully further observations will tell. And why don't we see a radio planarian? Well, that's a good question. Brian and others have been thinking about this a lot. And in this paper that basically has just been accepted, hopefully we'll put it on the web soon, we argue, taking some models, using some models from Reynolds and Chevalier in 1994, that if you have a pulsar that has a very, very high magnetic field, it basically just spins down very rapidly early on, dumps all that energy into the sort of forming nebula, and then the losses of the expanding nebula just render the planarian sort of invisible very soon after that. It basically has a very short lifetime as an observable planarian at any reasonable level of sensitivity, just due to the expansion of the nebula, and so you don't see it. Now, the funny thing is, so that's so much for this pulsar in a way, but then you look at this table that I've put down here of the five or six youngest pulsars as ranked by characteristic ages. So these are all the pulsars with less than 5,000-year-old characteristic age. Two of them are in the LMC, so never mind those for a second. You have these four in the galactic disk. This one is an X-ray-only pulsar, but probably just a pulsar that spins down, like most radio pulsars, discovered by Eric Gotthelf and collaborators at Columbia. And that has an age of 700 years old only. But so you have these four pulsars, and you have, of course, the Crab, prototypical, let's say, young pulsar. And then you have these three, which are slowly rotating pulsars with respect to the Crab. They have high magnetic fields with respect to the Crab. And they have, of course, low spin-down luminosities with respect to the Crab. And in a way, never mind these two LMC pulsars, of course, they are much like the Crab in some sense. And that's those are the ones we see. It's a selection effect. They are easy to see from across the galaxy or into other nearby galaxies even. But if you consider just our own galaxy, three of the youngest four pulsars are nothing like the Crab at all. And they're basically very hard to detect. You don't see planarians unless you find them in, well, either in X-rays, let's say, or like this one was found, or in a radio server like this one was found in. You wouldn't see them. So you might, you know, there are lots of supernova remnants that don't seem, shell supernova remnants that don't seem to have planarians or no apparent young pulsars at the center. But maybe they do. Some of them do, and they're just very hard to see, to detect. So much for young pulsars. Now let me go on to binaries. So this is a list of the binary pulsars we've found so far in the multi-beam survey. And I list them here in increasing order, sort of, well, more or less, increasing order of age, characteristic age. You have a couple that are fairly young, million-year-old, and then you have several that are several billion years old. And also by companion type, there's a main sequence binary here, there's a young neutron star white dwarf binary, a double neutron star binary, and then several old neutron star white dwarf binaries. These two have been published. I won't spend much time on them. These two have just been submitted, and I will spend some time on this very interesting object and make a few comments about these five as a group. Here, by the way, I just have one plot from this Caspi et al. Paper on this young neutron star white dwarf binary. We've been able to obtain a very good total mass estimate for that system from a measurement of the rate of advance of periastron. And we see that the neutron star has a mass of less than 1.35 solar masses. Presumably that is, in fact, about the level of the mass of the neutron star. It probably is not much less than that, which means the companion is a one solar mass white dwarf. But the interesting thing about this system, one of the interesting things, is that the white dwarf was formed prior to the neutron star in this system. This is an eccentric binary as opposed to the circular binaries that you normally see white dwarfs.
Is there any hope of detecting Shapiro delay?
It looks very long. Shapiro delay, no, I don't think so. But geodetic precession, for instance, perhaps. It's a very, very narrow pulse shape. Just briefly, because I mentioned neutron star masses, I have this little interlude here, which is something that I think is remarkable. All these neutron star mass measurements that Thorsted and Chakrabarty had made in 1999, that now would have to be a bit updated. After all, in the meantime, the system has been discovered by here Martin and Shri not to be a new double neutron star system. And in the meantime, we've also obtained some mass estimates for other systems. And so the average mass of a neutron star in binary radio pulses seems to be 1.35, give or take 0.05 of a solar mass. And I just want to summarize a couple of interesting points I find here. So there are three of these neutron stars that we believe have not accreted any mass at all. And here are their masses, one good limit and two masses. And so they are somewhat different.
Not accreted much.
Not accreted, well, anything. Well, perhaps, of course, they've accreted just post-collapse.
You're thinking of the companions.
No? Yes, yes, yes.
Okay. Yeah.
These are the double neutron star binaries.
But they're not a recycled pulse.
That's right. Okay. That's right. And then there are three systems in low-mass binary pulses where one thinks a lot of accretion has taken place. They've gone through a low-mass X-ray binary phase and so on. And on the order of one solar mass has been lost from the system or has been transferred from the companion either to the pulsar or has been lost from the system or so on. And there are three of these systems that now have a mass limit of 1.5 solar masses, basically.
Does this assume anything for the companion?
Yes, it does. It assumes a lot of, you know, what you might call massy astrophysics. It does assume.
Fair enough.
Yes. But so if you believe that and you can read the papers, then less than 0.15 solar masses has been accreted onto the neutron stars, which is, again, another interesting point. And maybe later I can ask Martin in more detail. In the past, at least, I remember seeing plots like this for X-ray binaries and with some massive neutron stars, which had sort of large masses. I would like to know if there are any reliable masses that are greater than 1.5 solar masses. And if so, I mean, how do you put that together with this summary from radio pulsars. After all, one thinks X-ray binaries and these systems are in some way related. On to that, I think, very interesting system that Ingrid Stairs and a bunch of us have just written a paper on. So I'll rush through these observations. This is a 0.6 second pulsar with a characteristic age of a third of a million years, so that nothing unusual about that. What's unusual is that it's a binary with a fairly long period, 230 days, high eccentricity. You see here the velocity curve, and the Keplerian mass function gives you a companion mass of greater than 11 solar masses. And there are no eclipses observed. I mean, you see here one passage of periaster, and we saw the pulsar just fine, but there have been a few since then where we've looked at it far more carefully, and there are no eclipses observed. So you might wonder what the companion is. Is it a black hole, for instance, or is it a main sequence star of some sort? It's definitely not a white dwarf, 11 solar masses. Here are some further results. What this is, at the bottom here, you have timing residuals at 1400 megahertz at one frequency. And then with respect to that model, we have timing residuals at a lower frequency as a function of orbital phase near periastron. Now what this shows is that there's increased dispersion measure just before periastron and maybe a little bit afterwards. But this is sort of a dirty system. There are some electrons there that are contributing some extra dispersion along the line of sight. And so, presumably, there have also been some polarization observations that show that there are variations in the polarization characteristics as a function of orbital phase. So presumably, well, this means it's not a black hole companion. although, well, in the paper we have one sentence at some point that if you think of some weird geometries and some foreground objects and so on, one could still appeal to a black hole companion. It's not like we want it to be a black hole companion, it's just that the observations are actually not all entirely consistent with each other, I think. But this, I would say, definitely argues against the black hole companion. And so you think, okay, main sequence, so let's look for a sort of a bright, shining star in there. Of course, this pulsar is about 1 degree away from the galactic center at a distance of 10 kiloparsecs or so. So it's hard to find anything there. But with infrared, with good infrared imaging, we found this star, which is very consistent with the pulsar position. It's 0.3 or so arc seconds away from the pulsar position with an uncertainty of half an arc second or so in this image. Okay, magnitude of 10. And then we took a spectrum of this star, also in Australia at the AAT. And here's the spectrum, infrared spectrum. And this suggests, we are reliably told, that it's a late type K5 to M3 star. There's also this somewhat unusual emission, bracket gamma hydrogen emission there. And at first we thought, okay, this must be the companion. We found the companion.
Late type main sequence star.
Main sequence star.
Sure, no, it's not the kind.
Well, okay, so it'd be super. Supergiant if it was to be an 11 solar mass star. Right, exactly. But is that really consistent? Well, and the answer is not really, because the magnitudes, when you put together colors and magnitudes and so on, you come to the conclusion that this would have to be at a distance of at least 23 kiloparsecs to be a supergiant companion. Well, the dispersion message suggests a distance of only about 11 kiloparsecs. So that's at least a factor of 2, which by itself I don't think would be a fatal.
But that spectrum is consistent with it being a supergiant?
Yes, okay. It is.
Could the K supergiants fit into the system?
No. That's point number 2 here, I believe. So that's a problem. So the observations, so if that were to be a supergiant, it really would have to be much further away than what we think it's at. On the other hand, it's consistent with being a sort of a one solar mass red giant at the galactic center at 10 kiloparsecs or so. That's point number 1. Point number 2 is that a supergiant of that mass would really have a huge radius, greater than 1 AU, whereas the closest approach of the pulsar to this star is less than 1 AU. And because there is no evidence of recycling in the system, we think that at least at periastron, the star is confined to its Roche lobe, which is about 0.4 of AU. So these numbers don't match too well. Let's go on with other problems. We measure at omega dot the rate of advance of periastron for this system, but it's fairly small. And for a supergiant of that type, you would expect that the tidal and spin quadrupoles would be much larger and would produce sort of order of magnitude larger omega dot than we observe. On the other hand, what we see, I think, is consistent with some early type B companion, which would produce a small omega dot, would produce a small mass loss rate consistent with the observed changes in dispersion measure. Again, a supergiant really should have a mass, even if it was confined. You know, even if it was much further away than the distance model suggests, even if it was smaller in some way, you'd still expect it to have some fairly massive wind that would result in dispersion measure changes a couple of orders of magnitude higher than what we see. So we think the most likely explanation is that, in fact, the companion is just an unseen B star or something like that. That's the magnitude of which, K magnitude of which, would be 15 or so, and just would not change what we observe.
What's the likelihood that KM star is just a random background?
A random, yeah. You know, star in the bulge, sort of a one solar mass. Apparently, there are many of these stars in the galactic bulge. And,
but do you have any idea how statistically?
No, we don't have that number yet. We're sort of
the picture certainly had many more.
Right, then you have a good radio position, right?
Yeah.
Sure, but.
Yeah, we're still arguing this, and this is, I said we'd submitted, I guess we haven't quite submitted the paper, partly because we're having all these discussions, and I'd love to have discussions with you during this week about the system.
Should be straightforward to estimate that with two maps.
Right. Yeah, this was, by the way, this source was also found in two mass. This supergiant or whatever it may be. So there are further measurements to be done on this system, obviously. And we'll figure out what's going on here. It's an interesting system, though. Right, and like I mentioned here in this point, but there are two other main sequence neutron star systems known. They are both B stars with 10 solar mass. One of them is a BE star, and the other one is a B star in the SMC. So the most likely explanation, I think, is that it's such a system.
Bracket gamma emission result.
Yes, and that's another interesting part. That bracket gamma emission seems to be variable. We've looked at it just this month, last month again. And resolved in width. I'm sorry. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
Suppose that you just had a BE star and these HBs are superposed, then the bracket gamma emission might actually be from the fainter B star.
The other thing about that bracket gamma emission is that it's very bright if you work out the numbers. And if it's, for instance, the pulsar that's actually producing that in some sense, the pulsar doesn't have enough spin-down energy. That would take 20% of the spin-down energy, that line alone, and of course there are other hydrogen lines somewhere. So let me briefly, I think I'll just very quickly rush through these intermediate mass binaries, because I want to get, in the end, to the globular clusters. And this is a little more technical point on binary evolution and so on, which I really want to discuss with some of you during the week. So let me just first flash this up here, which was meant to summarize, for a less knowledgeable audience, something about how we think that some binaries evolve. The traditional low-mass X-ray binary, one thinks there's a long period, hundreds of millions of years, of stable mass transfer, and so we think we can take the core mass radius relationship, which that at the end implies a relationship between the helium white dwarf mass and the orbital period of the radio pulsar. And that has been known or discussed for many, many years. Torres and Savo and I have sort of updated this, done some calculations, numerical calculations, non-conservative mass transfer, of course binaries with sort of one or two solar mass donors. And what they come up with is this binary period companion mass relationship, which is this one gray line up here that then turns into carbon-oxygen white dwarfs, 0.45 solar masses. And that's their line from this paper. And I haven't, or they haven't plotted it here, but most of the binary pulsars that we know of, the circular binary pulsars, are down here with orbital periods of less than 100 days. And of course, we usually don't know the companion mass too well. So in general, the companion masses within the uncertainties are consistent with this relationship, but there are large uncertainties. But for whatever it's worth, this is an updated, perhaps more reliable calculation for what that relationship is expected to be. Well, and then you have, by now, 12 other binary pulsars that are listed here with these stars. And the vast majority of them, you see, have quite much larger companion masses that would fit this relationship. They have masses of 0.5 or greater solar masses. And many of those, one expects, are carbon, oxygen, or even more massive white dwarfs. How does one explain the evolution of those systems? Some early suggestions, well, for instance, by Ed Vandenhoven and others, were that some of these systems will have to undergo a common envelope phase. In their binary evolution, where the orbital parameters, the size of the orbit just shrinks very much as the pulsar sort of plows into the extended atmosphere, the outer envelope of this massive star, and then just through frictional drag, it sort of sinks into the center, towards the center of the star, ejects the envelope, perhaps, of the companion star. And you end up with a sort of tight binary, a more massive companion. So that was a suggestion. And then Torres and Hoyo and Savonai recently have updated the work of Torres and Savonai, and they've considered intermediate mass donors from 2 to 6 solar masses. And they come to the conclusion that depending on sort of orbital parameters, and therefore on the state of evolution of the companion, when mass transfer starts occurring, it's possible to avoid this common envelope phase. So that's, I think, an interesting point. And in particular, the suggestion is for some of these systems, you don't necessarily need to have a very long-lived X-ray phase. In fact, some of them you just might not see them at all as X-ray systems. And this, I think, to the present point, it's a bit of a hand-waving argument, but I like it anyway, is that this sort of evolution basically gives you, in the end, larger magnetic fields and larger spin periods. It's not very efficient in spinning the neutron stars to very short periods or in decreasing their magnetic fields to very low values, as are observed for most millisecond pulsars. So that's nice because, in fact, many of these systems, not only do they have a larger companion mass, they also have larger spin periods and larger magnetic fields than your typical low-mass pulsar, low-mass binary pulsar. But whether that's, of course, the desirable thing would really be to do very accurate sort of evolution and particular thermal response of a neutron star to mass transfer, different mass transfer rates and so on, and see what sort of binary, what sort of magnetic fields and spin periods you can end up with. That would be interesting to do. I really won't go through the rest of this, just to say that the whole reason I'm bringing this up is that in this SPARC survey, both in these couple of papers, we have now found a lot of these sort of strange, relatively strange binary systems. Here is a PP dot diagram, now just the sort of lower left-hand corner where the binary pulsars are. And I draw your attention in particular to the heavy, to the large dots here. Those are the new systems I'm talking about, these seven new systems that I point out here. And what you see is that compared to the typical millisecond pulsar, they have larger spin periods between 10 and 100 milliseconds, basically, and larger magnetic fields between 10 to the 9 and 10 to the 10 Gauss. Also, if you put this plot here of orbital eccentricity versus orbital period, and if you note for a minute the circles, those are the low-mass binary pulsars, these, they pretty much follow this relationship derived by Finney back in 1992. Very nice work, and they followed very nicely. On the other hand, the squares, which are these new systems, they really are scattered all over the place. They tend to have much higher eccentricities than the low-mass binary pulsars. So something is different in the evolution of these systems, for sure. And quite, well, the very massive ones with companion masses of one solar mass or so, they probably cannot avoid common envelope evolution anyway. But then there are three of these systems, the orbital parameters of which would suggest sort of typical evolution, that they are low-mass systems, they have 0.3 or 0.2 solar mass companions. But the spin parameters are very different. They are longer periods, larger magnetic fields. So how do you get these systems? Well, perhaps this work of Taurus suggests a way out of it. Perhaps they come from more massive donors and avoiding a common envelope evolution end up with the systems that we get. Now, if that's true, for instance, just as a remark here, you cannot just throw these systems in together with the normal low-mass binary pulsars and sort of do birth rate calculations and so on and just assume that these are all the same, they all come from low-mass X-ray binaries and so on. I think we're getting to the point where we're finding many different systems and you really have to start wondering what are the evolutionary paths of various of these systems before you throw them in the same bag and just calculate a birth rate or so on. And the last point here was, why are there so many of these, what I call intermediate, or other people have called them also, intermediate mass binary pulsars in recent surveys? Of the 12 systems that I would personally call intermediate mass binary pulsars, seven of them have been found in the past couple of years in our survey and in this other survey at Parkes. So what I did the other day is I just went and looked it up in some catalogs, and the low-mass binary pulsars have a scale height of about 0.4 kiloparsecs. And some of them are really way up there, at more than 2 kiloparsecs above the galactic plane. Whereas the intermediate mass binary pulsars, of course, these are not huge numbers, but they seem to have a smaller scale height, I would say. The median is half, and the maximum is only 0.5. So if in fact this is true, and the intermediate mass ones have a scale height of factor 2 to 4 or so less than the others, why is that? Well, if they had smaller velocity, that would give you a smaller scale height, and why would they have a smaller velocity? Well, I leave this last sentence here, which there's a lot behind this sentence, I think, a lot of assumptions and asymmetries in supernova and so on that are required to make that a true statement. But that it presumably has something to do with their different evolution and the different kinds of systems that they are. But I would like to discuss that with some of you this week, I think. Right, so let me spend the last 5 minutes or so, ten minutes, all right, talking about globular clusters, which I'm very much enjoying working on lately. I remember when I was doing my PhD at Arecibo, I was searching for millisecond pulses in the disk of the galaxy, and I would just sort of scoff at these people working on globular clusters. You know, they say, oh, these are ridiculously weak systems, and you can't do anything with them once you find them, and you use all this supercomputer time to find all these guys. But now I've joined the dark side. I've come around, and there are reasons for that, hopefully, not just the fact justify what I'm actually doing. So, a brief background. When the first millisecond pulsar was found in 1982, this immediate model came up that suggested the formation and evolution model that said, well, low-mass binary pulsars undergo this low-mass X-ray binary phase beforehand, and so on. And since in globular clusters there are many low-mass X-ray binaries, the sort of specific incidence of low-mass X-ray binaries is high in clusters, it seemed like a natural place to go and search for millisecond pulsars. And after a few years of effort, some were found, and then over a period of 6 years or so, 32 pulsars were discovered in 12 clusters. The majority of those were isolated pulsars, which is sort of unusual because the majority of them were also millisecond pulsars. Only 3 of them are slow pulsars. In fact, you might want to ask, why are any of them slow pulsars? But that's a different question. But among the millisecond pulsars that were found, the majority were isolated, which is totally in contrast with the situation that one has in the galactic disk, where the vast majority of millisecond pulsars are in binary systems. But that's not hard to understand, presumably, because in globular clusters, there are a lot more interactions, obviously, and systems can get disrupted and so on. But never mind that. Now, about these 32 pulsars, the vast majority of these 12 clusters had one or two known pulsars in each. There was one or two pulsars in each, except for two clusters, very special clusters, M15, that's visible from Arecibo, where 8 pulsars had been found, and 47 TUF, that's visible from Parkes, where 11 pulsars had been found. There's another big difference in these two clusters, and that is that at Arecibo, these 8 pulsars can be seen almost every time that you look at the cluster with a telescope. They're bright enough, or the telescope is large enough and with high enough sensitivity and so on, that you can just study those pulses very well. And Stuart Anderson and other collaborators did really wonderful work on this cluster with timing. They got the timing solutions for these pulsars, which means they got the positions very accurate, sub-milliarcsecond positions for these pulsars, period derivatives, some of which are negative period derivatives. That is, it seems like the pulse is spinning up rather than spinning down, but that's really due to the acceleration in the cluster potential, and so you can learn something about the cluster potential and so on. Really wonderful work. Unfortunately, in 47 TUC, these pulsars are mostly not visible. You look at the cluster, you take your data, you reduce your data, and you see one or two pulsars each day. And you have to look at it hundreds of times, literally, before you really have any reasonable sort of number of detections from any of these pulsars. And the reason is, well, they're very weak to begin with, but also this cluster has low dispersion measure. And what that ends up doing is it means that the pulsars scintillate a lot. The apparent fluxes go up and down a lot, and you only see the vast majority of the pulsars when the interstellar weather is good, when the weather is propitious and the SFF is focusing and you see the pulsar. Now, that's a very big problem for obtaining timing solutions. For timing solutions, at first, you really need to detect the pulsar on sort of consecutive days. And sort of every time you decide you have to look at it, you must detect it. And this was not possible. So only 2 of these systems, of these 11, actually had timing solutions, so positions in the cluster and period derivatives, which was a bit of a shame. So now you jump a few years ahead. And basically, people gave up, I think, for a while on this work because it was just too hard. You had to integrate for hours and hours. And of course, if some of these systems are binary systems and you do an integration of 2 hours on a cluster and then you reduce that and you do an FFT, a Fourier transform, if it's a binary system, the period is changing during, and so doing an FFT doesn't do you much good. You have to do so-called acceleration searches, which basically take into account the changing in the parent period, and those are very expensive computationally, even today, and certainly 5 years ago more so. Anyway, so you jump to 2000, and we have this wonderful receiver at Parkes, the center beam of which we can use to do globular cluster work, because one beam alone is good to cover a lot of many clusters. And then, well, computers have improved a bit since then, so we can also do some more serious reduction work. So over the past year, basically, well, past 2 years, and most of this, a lot of this work is really unpublished still, but here's what we or and other people have found. In 47 TUC, 11 more pulsars. So there's now 22 of them. And the recent 11 are all binary systems. TERZN5, which has a very wonderful binary system known, TER5A, has had one more millisecond pulsar discovered. This one has been published. And then there are four other globular clusters on which Nikki D'Amico and a bunch of us have been doing some work. Those are all unpublished, but we found a few millisecond pulsars in these four different globular clusters, which I'll just list for completeness. This is the first one. Scott Ransom also took some data at Parkes and reduced it in a different way, and that's this sort of pretty picture here, which I won't really go into. There's no point. But this is a 1.7-hour binary, and this is a half-hour integration that we did on the system to discover it. And obviously, in half hour, that's a significant fraction of the orbital period, and the period changes. Now, this track, the dashed line here, the dashed ellipse, is the path that the pulsar makes in the period derivative plane during the entire orbit. And during the half hour of integration, it moved from here about 11 o'clock to here about 3 o'clock. So all the power was really spread through this bit of the path. And of course, what we're doing here with this acceleration search is just we're sweeping the power and sort of we bring it here. And even then, the fact that this is not a perfect sort of Gaussian means that our constant acceleration approximation in our search is not accurate enough. We're still losing some signal because of that, which hints at better things that one can do if one has the computing power. That's one system, and it's kind of interesting. It has a companion mass of only about 10 Jupiter masses. So that's sort of light.
Ransom didn't. That's about how Ransom found a pulsar, right?
Yes, this was you're probably thinking of his other way of...
That
no, not that other way of this technical point on how to do acceleration searches. But this was done in the Fourier space, acceleration in Fourier space. So that's one globular cluster. And then here's a summary of the other three. So then there was the 6397, a lovely cluster for which several people, Josh Grinley and others, have for years been pestering people like Dick Manchester and others to go out and try to find millisecond pulsars because they should have millisecond pulsars, he claims, and because of the X-ray systems that they see and so on. And finally, we found one pulsar in this cluster. And it's a binary pulsar. And somewhat unexpectedly, it shows eclipses. What you see here is that through a quarter of its orbit, we don't see the pulsar, even though we looked at it. And I say it's unexpected because it's a companion mass of 0.2 solar masses, a one-day period. Looking at the binary parameters, you'd say this is probably 0.2 solar mass helium-white dwarf, you know, if this was in the disk of the galaxy. But of course, a helium-white dwarf in the disk of the galaxy, or anywhere else for that matter, wouldn't give you an eclipse like this. So, what is it? We don't know. We don't yet have accurate positions for these new systems. Some of these are like M15 in the sense that we see them every time we look at them, and so within a year we will have accurate positions. And then we can look at HST pictures and God knows what else and try to see companions and so on. Others are like 47 TUC in that scintillation plays a big role and it'll be much harder. So finally, there are these two globular clusters here. Now, if I believe Dick Manchester in October actually mentioned these briefly, summarized this work, if he had any time, at least I went to the website here at the ITP and I saw some sheets that had reference to these clusters, although at the time you would only have had one in each of these clusters. In the past month, you found several more pulsars in each of these clusters. So it's looking good. This cluster, 3 binaries. This cluster, 1 binary and 4 isolated pulsars, all millisecond. And this cluster has a low DM. Pulsars scintillate a lot. That's a pain in a way, but it enables us to detect many pulsars that we otherwise would not. So enough of that. The summary as of today, I'm sure it'll be different a month from now, is 54 pulsars, 30 of them binaries. So by now, the majority are binaries. It really is a selection effect. You know, with acceleration searches, you start finding more binaries. Still not all of them, but and 16 clusters have pulsars in them. And so I think what, in a way, the very interesting thing from all of this work, apart from the individual discoveries, that it shows that a lot of these millisecond pulses remain to be discovered in globular clusters. And by the way, most of these, or all of these clusters that I just mentioned, these four, they had all been looked at in the past with the best equipment that was available and so on 5 years ago. It's just now we have better equipment and we go and the first day we look at it, we find pulsars that were there all the time. It's just undiscovered.
How many of the isolated pulsars that you're finding in these clusters have negative p-dots?
We don't yet have p-dots for any of these.
For any of them, okay.
Right. It'll take a year or so. These, for some of them, for others, much longer. I had this sheet, which I'll just briefly refresh. I definitely won't discuss the details, but it was like my sort of, because I did sort of spend a lot of time have in the past couple of years dealing with reducing data from these clusters or some clusters. And you really should, from now on, nobody should be allowed to do a survey of a cluster without doing acceleration reduction. It should be a law. On the other hand, it still is expensive computationally, and there are problems. And most people so far only do, they assume a constant acceleration during the integration. And sure, once we find a pulsar in a given cluster, we know the dispersion measure, so we can do more exciting, more difficult things in the reduction. But still, can we do a full Keplerian search? No, that's ridiculous, even today. But one can go sort of step by step, doing a better search of the entire phase space. And here's an example of that 1.7-hour binary that we discovered recently that I talked about. Here's another 30-minute integration. And what you see, I just want to point your attention to these three plots. Here you see the sort of the data folded at the best period, the best average period during that 30-minute integration. And you see this curvature, and if you just sum these data in one dimension down here and try to make a pulse profile, it would be totally smeared out. You'd hardly see anything. Here, I show how we actually found this pulsar by doing a constant acceleration search. And, well, we found the pulsar, so it works. This is also a strong pulsar, actually, sort of. But the point is, you still will lose some signal. It's still not straight. And then here, we take an extra derivative, and for this system, in any case, that's good enough. There would be no point in going higher than that, and this is the pulse profile that you get. And so that's great. Now, this is a 1.7-hour binary. Of course, if this was an 11-minute binary, with a 30-minute integration, this approximation would not have been very good. And that's really the point. There could be all sorts of wonderful exotic systems in these globular clusters. And of course, for instance, from X-ray data, we know of an 11-minute binary in one cluster. I think these next few years will be quite interesting for globular cluster work in the radio because of this. And there are new telescopes, and some telescopes have good front and back ends, and computing is really where it's at, and that's always improving. So I'm very hopeful for that. Great, so you find all these pulses in all these clusters, and then what do you do with them? So I'll finish by talking about what we've done and are doing still with 47 TUC, where finally we found more pulsars, 11 of them, so there are now 22 of them, but more importantly in a way, or as importantly, we've actually gotten timing solutions for many of them. So here's a table from, I guess it was this paper, modified. And what you see is that the previously known 11 pulses, 4 of them were binaries, these 4. of the new pulsars, I only list 9 here, all of them are binaries. So this was a selection effect, the fact that we didn't see too many binaries in the past. There were no acceleration searches done when these pulsars were discovered. There are acceleration searches done now. And here I give a remarkably good example of that. This is the discovery of 47 tuck R, which as of today, it's the shortest binary period of any radio pulsar, 96-minute binary, discovered in an 18-minute integration with acceleration searches. And here's the discovery plot, signal-to-noise ratio versus trial acceleration. And there's zero acceleration. And here's 12 meters per second squared or so. So there's a reason why we didn't find these pulsars before. And also I want to point, guide your eye to this last column, which is the flux density, average flux density of these pulsars, which is actually a lot of work to get this number, but I basically believe these uncertainties. They could be off by a factor of 2, but you can trust these, I think. And what you see is we're talking about 30 microjanskis average flux density here at 1400 megahertz. Now, that may not mean much to some of you who, what's 30 microjanskis? Is that a lot? Is that a little? That's about a factor of 50, 10. It's only a factor of 30 or so less than what the Parkes multibeam survey can detect. In other words, a millisecond pulsar of this kind has to have a flux density of actually about 0.5 millijanskis at the very least. Close to 1 millijansky is more like it, actually, before it would be detected. So how come with 18-minute integrations as opposed to half-hour integrations, which is what we use in the multibeam survey, and with the same equipment, how come we're detecting these? Well, the point is these scintillate. And we definitely don't detect these guys when they have an apparent flux density of 30 microjanskis. We detect them when they have an apparent flux density of a millijansky. And that doesn't happen very much for this guy. It happens quite a lot for the strongest pulsar here, which has an average flux density of half a millijansky, and we detect it almost every day. And then these are so weak that I have not been able to estimate their flux densities. This guy, 47.R, for which you don't see a flux density, it's a flux density of the order of 10 microjanskis. The beauty is, and it's sort of a ridiculous thing when you consider, we've only seen this pulsar once on one day. It's the discovery day. Now, why am I sure that this is a pulsar? It's because it has an orbital period of 96 minutes, and we looked at the cluster for 4 hours, even though we reduced the data in 18-minute chunks because of computing power issues. But it was there for all those 4 hours, so we saw like 3 orbits, you know, this beautiful sort of sine wave. Got the parameters, got the orbital parameters, and we've never seen it since. It's there.
So how do you know what the real flux densities are?
For those, you don't.
For ones that are 30 microjanskis.
Okay, because we see them enough, and by enough I mean this guy, we see 10% of the time. We've now looked at the cluster a few hundreds of times. So you can, in essence, build a histogram of what interstellar scintillation does to flux densities. And it will affect all pulsars similarly. These are all at the same location. And so you basically know at what level, what point in the tail of scintillation, of flux density you're at, if you detect it.
So basically, we can, in principle, online decide, oh, I don't, I'm, my, even my brightest pulsar is not very bright, let me go to another cluster.
Okay. No, that's okay. No. It's not, it's not like every pulsar is strong or weak on the same day. No. And that's an interesting thing that we're still working on to see if we can learn something from that. But one pulsar, it's an assumption, of course, I guess, but one pulsar in 47 tuck, we feel if you think about it over a period of 1 year, will be magnified by a factor of 3, let's say, as much as any other pulsar in 47 tuck. I mean, that's what.
And that's a statistical.
Yes. So, 22 pulsars so far. Now, I boldly claim in our paper up there that there's at least, I get, you know, at least 500 of them in the cluster. Where do I get 500 from? I just take the luminosity function that I get from those 11 or whatever it is that we have fluxes for, and I see what we know about pulsars in the disk of the galaxy, millisecond pulsars and their luminosities, and what we know about M15 and so on. It's obvious that there are more, right? We're seeing the brightest ones. There are weaker ones. How many more? I'm confident in that number. Now, when are we going to find those 500 or 1,000? Well, most of them will find them on the first day of operations of the square kilometer array, whenever, if ever that occurs. Until then, it'll be slow going. Because now, in a way, we've hit another barrier. I mean, those 11 pulsars, we found them in the first sort of 6 months of taking data with a new system. We've now been, the first nine, we found them in the first 6 months. And now for the past year and a half, more or less, we found two more. We've reached another barrier. Computationally, we can still do better. And we might find a few more interesting ones. Anyway, so all of those are millisecond pulsars. 70% of them are in binary systems. I emphasize again, I'm sure the true fraction is higher. And the binaries are of two types, basically. One is a sort of a one-day binary with a 0.2 solar mass companion and a small eccentricity, although it's much larger than equivalent systems would have in the disk of the galaxy. And that presumably is because this eccentricity comes from interactions with other stars in the cluster, in some sense, not from the binary evolution that led to the circularization of the system. And then the other systems are a few hour binaries, 0.3% of a solar mass, and sometimes eclipsing. Those are the two kinds of binaries. Now, the one thing is we have been able, for 15 of these 22 pulses, we have been able to measure positions and p dots to very high precision. So we know 15 with positions. Here they are. Here's the center of the cluster with a core radius and the positions of 15 of those pulsars. The ones with a cross, which you probably can't see, have positive p dots. The ones with a dot at the center have negative p dots. Nine of them have negative p dots. Six of them have positive. You know, you might.
So how many have negative p dots?
Nine.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, from symmetry, you'd expect half and half, but you know, it's only 15 objects. So, I mean, that's fine. And then, so here are the positions. Very nice. And then you have a cumulative distribution here of the offset, projected offset from the center of the cluster in core radius for these 15 pulsars. And what you see is this linear distribution here, in essence, is telling you that the space distribution of these pulsars goes like 1 over r squared, sort of an isothermal distribution, which might be what you would expect, although I think there are some things we definitely don't understand about this. And again, I hope I have a chance to discuss this with some of you. Certainly one thing I think we don't understand is why is there this abrupt cutoff? You know, there's like 1 over r squared, and then suddenly, boom, there's nothing else there. I think that's a bit of a mystery, but maybe some of you think it's obvious, and I'd love to talk about it. About the binaries, there are what I call normal binaries and short period binaries. Okay, the normal binaries are the ones that are wider, with a period of sort of a day or so, and then there's the short period binaries. There are no normal binaries in the core. The wide binaries, as it were, are all outside the core. And one can explain that, at least qualitatively, by saying, well, in the core, these large binaries that have a large cross-section are just going to get disrupted. Shorter time scale for disruption. They'll be ionized. And that's, I think, the qualitative explanation. You could work out the numbers.
Did you say something about comparing this with the core radius?
I'm sorry, say that again?
Could you make some comparison? I didn't quite catch it.
The core, I'm sorry, so this core radius is 20 arc seconds, and what is your question?
So the core radius is 20 arc seconds, so what's the core radius of the neutron stars?
Oh, the core radius of the neutron stars. So yeah, obviously this is the core radius from optical measurements and so on. You're asking what's the core radius of the neutron stars?
The neutron stars should be centrally concentrated.
Presumably more centrally concentrated, yes, and I've not measured that, I mean, with 15 objects.
It looks like they're much more scattered than one would
expect. Yeah, in a way, well, I mean, I just go, you know, to Spitzer or something, and you sort of look up the formulas and think about it, and it says, oh, well, at a radius greater than 3 core radii or something like that, you might expect it to have such a distribution. The funny thing is, all the pulsars are basically located within 3 core radii of the cluster, you know, as defined by the optical measurements. But yes, you would say, okay, the core radius of the neutron stars is smaller, well, whatever it is.
It's like 40% or so.
Right, so you might say, okay, so they still probably had a few core radii if you just consider the core radius of the neutron stars. But then I don't understand why it's just abruptly it's cut off. Oh, yes, of course, I'm sorry. The thing I really should mention, which I haven't before, that's my fault, is the beam size of the telescope that we use to do this survey is huge compared to this. So this is 1 arc minute. The radius of the beam that we have been using is 14 arc, the diameter is 14 arc minutes. But half of these pulsars, I'll remind you, were found a decade ago at lower frequencies, where the radius of the beam size of the telescope is about 30 arc minutes. So all of these pulsars are within the central 1% of the area that was covered in the search. So there are no pulsars out there. Yeah, okay, all that. So forget about what we've learned or learning about the cluster from all those P dots, and I'll just end. Well, we can talk about it. I'll be here till Friday. I'll just end with two very nice pictures, in particular one. So now we have 15 positions, so we can look at other wave bands and try to find some of these objects. Here's an X-ray image of the cluster with Chandra. Okay, this is unpublished. This is Josh Grindley et al. Working on a couple of papers on this. It's a beautiful image. It's over 100 sources over there in the central 1 arc minute of the cluster. Rosat had found sort of 9 blobs sources. We now see over 100. And from the point of view of pulsars, what's remarkable is that 12 of those are the pulsars. Out of those 15 pulsars, 12 of them are detected in X-rays. And since I have to wrap up, I won't go into this very much. You can ask me more if you want to know. But that'll be quite interesting. And then, of course, there's wonderful recent Hubble work, too. This is a picture. This was 8 days of integration on 47 Tuck with the Hubble to search for planets. They didn't find any planets, but of course it's a remarkable sort of data set to do other things with, and we're correlating again with the X-ray image and the radio work and try to learn something about it. Okay, well, that's it.
More questions?
I can ask about the eccentricities. If they're higher than what you expected, I mean, from secularization, what calculations have people done to look for the global effects of the global cluster? Excuse me.
I know Fred Razor and some collaborators have done some of that. Of course, they'll give you an eccentricity based on the amount of time that a certain system has spent at a certain location with a certain density and so on.
Barriers.
Right. And these things are presumably in orbit around the cluster and so on. And so to compare the eccentricities for the half dozen systems we get there with their calculations, I think you can only say, well, is within order of magnitude, even, you know, if there's a match within an order of magnitude, I think you'd say, all right, that's pretty good.
Right.
Now, for 6 of those systems, 4 of them have an eccentricity of the order of 10 to the minus 4, which is understandable in terms of those models that, for instance, Fred Razor has come up with. 2 of them have much higher. One of them has an eccentricity of 0.07, which is far, far higher than what he can come up with at all. And so you can appeal, for instance, to say, okay, this thing is a very eccentric orbit in the cluster, and once in a while it goes through, you know, the center of the cluster, and it really, really feels some force. If you say that, then at some point you're going to say, well, eventually it might get disrupted. And, you know, that might be the answer. It means maybe some of these isolated pulsars have been disrupted in that way, for instance. But I don't know what the answer is. But 2 of them definitely have very high eccentricities, 0.01 and higher.
You estimate there are 500 pulsars, detectable pulsars, basically, in 47. But how many neutron stars would you need to produce these 500?
Well, that's a very good question. And I don't know. And the other question to my mind is, how many have you kept in the cluster since formation? You know, the escape velocity is 60 kilometers a second, all these exchange interactions going on and so on. Is it reasonable? I don't know. Do we need to say something about kick velocities to either? Yeah. And I certainly don't have the answer for that.
But David's working on that, right?
Oh, yeah.
David will give us the answer by Friday.
You have about 10 to the 4, right? About 10 to the 4 supernovas in this global plus.
I don't know how.
Sort of well in a hundred of the 10 to the 6 stars, is that a reasonable?
You would.
This is a massive.
You want to keep there at least 10% of all the neutron stars in your clusters.
Yeah.
One thing incidentally that I'll mention I find interesting is that Chandra image, which is wonderful. We're still learning about those X-ray sources, but it seems clear to me that besides the 12 pulsars that we have already identified, some of the other unidentified X-ray sources will also be pulsars, neutron stars. Yeah. And in fact, I was doing some quick work before I came here. There doesn't seem to be much of a correlation between the X-ray flux and the radio flux of these pulsars. Whereas, of course, we only detect the ones that have, by definition, the highest radio flux. So, some of those are definitely. So, you know, in a couple months' time, hopefully, when we write this paper, we'll say something like, I'm just making the numbers up, but, okay, 10 more of these 100 sources in the Chandra image are definite pulsars, in addition to the 12.
But what else should they be, the other sources?
Well, so some of them are CVs, main sequence binaries.
Have CVs ever been seen?
I believe so, yes. I mean, some of this is work with correlating with the HST image and so on. About half of those are still not identified. And I think the idea is, once you've correlated with the HST image and you don't find optical companions, and you have X-ray sources that have more or less the same flux as the ones that we know to be radio pulsars. The radio pulsars, by the way, in the Chandra image, are not either the weakest or the brightest of X-ray sources. They're sort of in the middle there. And then we have variability information, hardness ratios, and so on. And there's, of course, the radial distribution to work on. You'll just have to say, okay, some of these are very good candidates for being neutron stars.
So CVs have been seen.
Yeah.
This,
yeah, and also main sequence. And I think before. Main sequence binaries. Yes, this had been known before. Yeah.
Those are then iris scan band stars.
Yeah. So.
Great. Okay, thank you again.